With only a few weeks to go until the snap general election on June the 8th, pensions have become a key part of the campaign. I'm Sophia Imerson, senior reporter at Pensions Expert, and I'm delighted to be joined by Malcolm McLean, senior consultant at Barnett Waddingham, and Edward Brown, partner at law firm Hogan Lovells, to discuss the pensions proposals included in the Labour, Conservative and Lib Dem manifestos. The Liberal Democrats plan to establish a review to look into introducing a flat rate of tax relief for pensions, which they say would be set more generously than the current 20% basic rate relief. Malcolm, were you surprised that pensions tax relief didn't crop up in the Tory manifesto?
Well, yes and no. Surprised that they didn't indicate in more precise terms what they had in mind, but not surprised really that they left it out. That doesn't mean to say that they're not going to do something about pensions tax relief. I think that's almost certain. What they have done, of course, is escape from the tax lock that the previous Prime Minister imposed upon the party for 5 years. That's no longer going to apply. So the Chancellor will have much more freedom to do things in relation to tax and therefore tax relief. And I expect a cash-strapped Chancellor over the next few years to have a good hard look at the cost of pensions tax relief and probably do something about it.
Yeah, I regarded that as a victory for the Treasury, the fact there hadn't been anything mentioned. If you haven't mentioned anything in the manifesto, you don't tie your hands. So I think they've given themselves flexibility to do something there.
And the current system of pensions tax relief, it's been described as costly and inefficient by some. If there are reforms to pensions tax relief, how do you think it should be done?
Well, the ideal, I suppose, would be that all the parties agreed ideally on what the best solution would be and sat down and worked it carefully through with experts. That's not going to happen. I suspect there will be a Treasury proposal which will be consulted upon. They might decide to sort of try and get an outside expert in to look at it, prepare a report, which they might then read or might then ditch. But to be honest, I suspect it will simply be the Treasury will work out what will get it the maximum savings that it thinks it can get away with and will then try and put that forward as policy, I think.
I think there probably was a time when the Conservatives would not have wished to have done anything about higher rate tax relief. But I think Mrs May is now showing that she is prepared to take on some of these issues, and I would expect them to introduce a flat rate of tax somewhere between 25% and 33%. It would have to be higher than 20% in terms of making it appear fairer to the low paid, but obviously less than 40% to make the savings that the Chancellor would want. So somewhere between 25% and 33%, and I would like it to be 33% if possible, the more the better, and to do something about trying to make people understand and appreciate the real value of tax relief, because that is one of the problems at the moment, that people don't actually understand that they're getting it, and there's a lot of money involved in this and it needs to be spelled out.
Okay, and moving on to auto-enrolment, the Conservatives have proposed to extend auto-enrolment to the self-employed. But they haven't made any explanation on how they plan to do this. How practical, Edward, do you think it would be to enable so-called gig economy workers to benefit from auto-enrolment? And could they look at using the national insurance system to address this issue?
They could. I mean, I think the gig economy and workers, I think the way you would deal with that is actually by amending the legislative definition of what a worker is. That would be the easiest way to then extend auto-enrolment to a wider group of people. What slightly surprised me in the manifesto was that it referred to auto-enrolment for the self-employed, which slightly, I confess, struck me as a contradiction in terms. The self-employed aren't going to send themselves notices about opting in or out of their own scheme. They can just use a personal pension scheme. I confess I read a bit of that as thinking there was a little confused and ill thought through.
And Malcolm, which aspects of auto-enrolment do you think aren't getting enough attention? I mean, does the issue of contribution levels need greater focus?
Well, absolutely. It's really a missed opportunity, in my view, that the current review of auto-enrolment is not actually going to look at the minimum level of contributions. And that really is the big issue, as far as I'm concerned, about auto-enrolment. There are too many people, I think, paying that lower rate of contribution without actually realising what a poor return they're going to get from it. And to put it off until a later date means that it's going to take a little while for any change to come in. Whereas, in fact, if they'd embraced it in the current review or brought it in now, then they could decide what to do and bring that in from 2020 when the current auto-enrolment phasing in programme is fully complete. And I think that really should be done. We do know that many people are going to benefit from auto-enrolment, but not going to benefit perhaps as much as they would expect. And therefore, it is important to get those contribution levels up.
I think that's absolutely right. It wouldn't entirely surprise me if in 5 years' time we did actually see higher minimum contributions. It also wouldn't surprise me if ultimately it becomes mandatory. That would be one way to cut down on a lot of the bureaucracy that surrounds auto-enrolment and ensure people were actually saving adequately for their retirement. That wasn't the approach that was taken a number of years ago when it came in, but it wouldn't surprise me if it does in the future.
Over recent years, a number of high-profile cases, the BHS scandal, for example, have thrown DB pensions further into the spotlight. And tougher regulation to protect pensions during certain company takeovers and corporate transactions is a key part of the Tories' pension proposals. Labour has also pledged to amend the takeover regime to protect workers and pensioners. So, Edward, to what extent are these party proposals to build on existing powers just a crowd pleaser?
To be perfectly honest, I think to a large extent. I think the existing powers in relation to corporate transactions basically work. They're not perfect and they could be tweaked at the margins, but they do basically work. I think the problem is that there has been an impression amongst the public and politicians of all parties that the BHS scandal arose because of a failure of regulation, and therefore the way to respond to that is to have more regulation going forward. I don't think that was what it was about at all. I don't think there's been enough adequate thought as to which bit of regulation allegedly failed, and then how do you replace that in order to make sure the system works better going forward. Basically a business that ran out of money and that stopped succeeding. That's basically where it all ended up. So no, I think it's just crowd pleasing, to be honest.
And how practical will these proposals be to carry out, particularly with regard to punitive fines and then also this new criminal offence for company directors who risk the ability of a scheme to meet its obligations?
The punitive fine idea is actually philosophically, it makes sense to me, because the position the courts have kind of taken at the moment is, if you do the wrong thing, then the maximum penalty you can pay is the contributions that you would have paid had you done the right thing. So if you, from a pure rational perspective, it's not a huge amount of incentive to do the right thing. So the punitive fines are supposed to make the wrong thing look much worse, and that's essentially why it's being proposed. So I can see the logic to that. The criminal offence, well, the manifesto said the Tories would consider introducing it. A tweet they put out a couple of weeks ago said they would do. So it's already been watered down a bit. It wouldn't surprise me if that fell into the too difficult box by the end of things.
I hope the regulator is honest with the government about the resource implications of these extra tasks that they will be asked to do, to make sure that they can actually do them. Because one of the things that we don't want to happen is to trivialise the takeover situation and to make it so that business actually becomes very frustrated about being unable to act without long delays in getting clearance from the regulator. So they need to be very careful about this and be very clear on what they're doing and who they're going to take on in this respect.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think it will be critical to know the threshold that they will set in order to have that mandatory notification. The regulator, in its response to the Select Committee inquiry, basically, I paraphrase slightly, but said, please don't make us have to do them all, because we simply don't have the resource to do that and we'll be overwhelmed. So I suspect it will only be the major transactions. But there is clearly a resourcing issue there.
Yeah, I was going to ask, does the regulator have the resources to do these things?
At the moment, no, to be honest. And I suspect the regulator would tell you that as well. They will either need more resources from central government or raise more through levies from schemes.
Yeah, and you've got to bear in mind they've got major tasks in hand with auto-enrolment still to come. We've got the small employers now on this, and things will not be as easy for the regulator as perhaps had been in the past. So there's a big challenge there for them.
As predicted, the Conservatives have said that they plan to scrap the triple lock guarantee and introduce a double lock in 2020, which would be cutting that 2.5% underpin. The Liberal Democrats and Labour, however, they've promised to maintain the triple lock. How financially sustainable do you think that would be?
I don't think the triple lock is sustainable over the long term. I don't think in the short term it will make that much difference, because inflation and average earnings rises are actually probably at or above the 2.5% minimum anyway. So in the short term, it doesn't make any real difference. But in the long term, there's no doubt about it, the triple lock will have an impact and will probably be unaffordable over that period of time. I would like to see some consideration given to trying to make the situation permanent, in the sense that, are we going to have a double lock and is that going to continue forever? Or at some point, is somebody going to say, well, this is all costing too much, we'll just have a single lock? So there's great uncertainty around, and people need to know, in planning their future retirement plans, exactly what's happening, particularly with the state pension, because the state pension is going to be the bedrock of many people's retirement situation, and therefore it is important that they know what they're heading for. So it's time to put this to bed, in my view, to make it clear. And I'm very pleased to see that the Conservatives appear to have done that, in the sense that they're not going along with the current vogue to try and win votes by simply coming up with keeping the status quo.
Is it likely, though, that the moving to a double lock would be seen as moving the goalposts and increasing uncertainty?
I think it is increasing uncertainty, as Malcolm rightly says. Basic state pension used to be increased by earnings, and then it was increased by reference to prices, and then it was increased by the triple lock, and now it's going to be the double lock, assuming the government is re-elected. I think there's a lot of uncertainty around it, but the problem is it's very expensive. We are in a time of heightened financial difficulty. It's, if you like, an easy place to try and make some savings from.
I don't think it would be unacceptable to actually go for a single lock based on earnings, because for many, many years the pensioner groups campaigned to restore the link with earnings, which was taken away in 1980 and didn't come back until in the form of the triple lock until 2010, was it, when it came in?
Yep. And
therefore, I think they might just about be prepared to accept that the link with earnings was what they've always wanted, and therefore that's what should continue. But it will be a big step, I think, for any new government at the moment to scrap two-thirds of the triple lock, and therefore they will go for this. It may not survive.
And on the topic of the state pension age, Labour plan to review the state pension age with a view to developing a flexible retirement policy to reflect variations in life expectancy and different nature of working lives. And the party also promised no further increases to the state pension age after 2020, whereas the Tories have said they'll continue to increase the state pension age as life expectancies increase. What questions do you think these different proposals raise in terms of intergenerational fairness?
Well, intergenerational fairness is an issue that is frequently cited as a reason for cutting back on, say, older people's benefits. But there's no clear link necessarily between that and giving younger people extra money. It doesn't seem to work out quite like that. Certainly, the Labour Party's proposals to actually freeze the state pension age at 66, in my view, is completely unaffordable, and various independent estimates have suggested that that would cost perhaps as much as £300 billion, which is a phenomenal sum of money and clearly is unaffordable. People are living longer, and I think we have to accept that the state pension age has to go back. That said, I think there may be something in the Labour proposals to try and look to find whether it's possible to allow people early access to the state pension in certain situations. Not what they've suggested, linking it to occupation or location, but perhaps on some sort of actuarial reduced basis, like happens with occupational schemes. For example, it is possible to claim 5.8% increase if you delay taking your state pension by a year. Therefore, that could be turned on its head, and you could get a 5.8% reduction if you took it a year early. There would have to be a minimum age, and that minimum age might be 66, but I think that's worth exploring. It's not everybody that's going to be capable of working on until these very later ages, and that's something I think that at some point any government is going to have to seriously address.
Edward, would you agree with that?
I think that's absolutely right. It has always seemed to me a slightly curious anomaly that you could take it late, but you can't take it early. I do think there's... I think the case for raising the state pension age is almost overwhelming, to be honest. Given we had ages of 60 and 65 since 1909 and barely even got round to moving them until very recently, and even then only moving up to 65 by 2020, I think the case for changing it is overwhelming. But I do think allowing people to take it early on a reduced basis would help deal with some of the concern where people say, well, I can't afford to wait to take my pension until my late 60s or 70.
Thank you, Edward. Thank you, Malcolm. For more on the general election, including our 2017 general election interview series with political candidates representing their parties on pensions issues, please visit pensions-expert.com.